So should we start with each group presenting in a few minutes what their observations from their group? I know from the group I sat in, Sandra was a willing volunteer there, but I don't know who is going to talk on this. Kevin, oh yeah, of course. Yeah. Kevin, you're always such a good soldier, so I have to say that. Go ahead.
From our group, although we spoke for quite a while in circles, we couldn't actually give an awful lot of focused guidance on where the effects analysis should be. We considered that if you're going to do the effects analysis, you've got to go broader than just from an IASB viewpoint. So we said you can't limit it to just the effect it's going to have on financial reporting, because we said financial reporting might be the remit of the IASB, but that's not the effect that necessarily is going to come through just on the any change in accounting standard, because although the change in accounting standard might have an effect on the presentation of the balance sheet or in the income statement, management have the ability to negate that effect through either non-GAAP measures or even through segment reporting. And we chose the equity accounting statement that if management choose to continue managing the operation on proportionate consolidation, then the segment reporting has no impact from a change in the financial reporting effect. So an effects analysis may have to explain an effect on financial reporting only. It may have to go down an effect on what it might do for management, because in some cases it might have, though we thought this was difficult to come out with, management might change the way they do business, that if they can't achieve a desired outcome, they might withdraw from that market because it gives the wrong return, the wrong impression of what is going on. We also said you needed to consider the effects analysis on the total economy, and then we cautioned about listening to the propaganda of the people that maybe not like an accounting standard, because the propaganda on the new leases statement is that EBITDA is going to be ruined, debt covenants are all going to fail, $200 billion is going to go on everyone's balance sheet. That might not be the effect if management's been proactive and already implemented plans to avoid that effect, and therefore be careful of the propaganda you might incorporate by accident because you're getting the wrong sort of data. We therefore thought that maybe the effects analysis needs to be, after it's been prepared, outsourced to somebody who's not involved, so that they can reconsider it to say, hang on, no, you've misinterpreted a statement here. But who that outsourced party, we couldn't answer. But it's difficult to do an effects analysis if your concentration on financial reporting, you're only going to think in financial reporting, and you're going to be blinkered in your approach, so you've got to find a way to get that wider.
So you feel the approach we are taking needs some more revision or some more thought on it?
We think it needs to be made wider. It's not as focused necessarily. I gave an example that we've had where we had an effect we would never have thought from IAS 39 as a result of contingent consideration in IFRS 3. I would never have gone there until I've seen it now in hindsight that it occurred. And so we thought that the ISB trying to do an effects analysis only on its by itself may end up too focusing and not actually think that there's a bigger picture, that there might be other effects. And I was explaining to Jacques, I just got an email now, which Papa Joe's, which is a pizza chain in America, they're going to cut all their employees' hours to less than 30 so they can avoid the effects of Obamacare on their temporary employees. That type of effect wouldn't be something that you would necessarily think of while you're doing a financial reporting effect, that there's other knock-on effects that you need to also think about considering.
Is there a risk of that becoming a kind of too broad and also a bully pulpit, to say the word, in terms of the IASB, because sometimes we might be crossing our remit. I'm just pushing back to say that.
Yeah, where we covered that was that actually, and this sounds very rude, the ISB needs to understand its constituency. And so in some of the countries that have adopted IFRS, they may not have adopted IFRS for SMEs, and therefore the small entity could be just as affected. It's not just entities which are represented here, which are multinationals listed and everything else. So how you do an effects analysis that covers such a wide remit, we didn't understand how it's feasible, because the FASB can sort of say, well, this is only applicable to here. We haven't considered whether you can take that route when actually the majority of the companies that have adopted IFRS are probably not the major listed entities, especially in countries that have done away with national GAAP entirely. So the effects analysis is very broad, and how you get that, we couldn't even give advice.
Thank you. Sandra, do you want to, then we can maybe, after your comment, the remaining time, we can have a general discussion.
Okay. We thought the effects analysis was extremely important from a credibility of the standards perspective, and spent most of our time talking about the benefit side of the cost-benefit ratio. If you looked at the benefits, we felt it was important to address benefits from the point of view of all the stakeholders, the investors, analysts, lenders, regulators, and management. Some of the comments that were made were that if the standard is truly useful, it's probably also useful to management. So if management's not getting any benefit from it, then you need to think about whether or not there is a real benefit associated with it. Another area we talked about was that when you start developing a standard, you should have already looked at what benefits you're going to achieve by doing the standard. So you have a starting point, and then you would revisit that over the term of the project to make sure that you're still staying aligned with that benefit, or if the benefits have changed, if you understand and believe that you've changed it in the right manner. With that, we started talking about when you start developing the standard, you have a theoretically pure answer that's the best answer, I guess. And as you move off from that theoretically pure answer to make it more operable, there's a cost benefit associated with that. And this discussion was whether or not we should be going through and working through and understanding those decisions and the impact on the benefits and costs. From a cost perspective, we spent some time talking about cost, you know, what is meant by cost. Similar to some of your comments, we see the implementation cost and the ongoing maintenance cost. Are there opportunity costs also that are being incurred? And are there economic costs or other macro costs that are being incurred by the company? Was there anything else?
Yeah, just a small word, and also to see the balance between the costs that we saved for the point of view of users and the cost that has been discerned by the company.
That would be, you know, if it takes a user 3 extra hours of pulling together information to do their modeling and analysis, but it takes the company, when you do it on a global basis, takes them 500 hours to do it they're on an ongoing basis. That, you know, is there a real benefit to the users there? Or benefit, cost benefit?
Anybody to add? Bill?
Just wanted to add a couple of points which came out over lunch, well, partly during the meeting, and one over lunch, and they are linked. First of all, I think you have to do it. You have to do these things, and to the extent that you can't find benefits or you can't define costs, be honest and say so. Okay, so don't ignore the issue. So if you say the benefits to preparers we believe are only intangible and there are no direct benefits, then say so. Far better to be upfront than have somebody coming back to you and saying you haven't assessed it. It also struck me that there's actually benefits to the ISB, so outside normal cost-benefit analysis, in that you are a private body and there are comments that the ISB is unaccountable. We've heard this many times, and I'm sure we'll hear it many more times in the future. By doing an effects analysis or a cost-benefit analysis, it demonstrates a commitment to accountability to your wider constituency. So I think, you know, these are important, one, to give the credibility to the standard, but secondly, the accountability and the credibility of the ISB, I think, can only be enhanced by doing something like this.
I personally, I took away something that Alan said at the towards the end of our meeting, and I thought, for a change, I'm just kidding. I think one thing which struck me, and I did not think about that in that sense, was that many of these projects started several years ago, and writing cost-benefit analysis or an effect analysis at this stage in game might be a little bit more challenging than, to the point that Bill is making, than to the future projects where a discussion paper is not going to start off without making this kind of thought process. I think I personally feel this is a work in progress to a large extent, and you will see a much more evolution of thought and progress in time of do it, and some maybe the points that Kevin is making or his group made about the wider impact and all would be, I would see that as we get more feedback on that, there will be an evolution on that. I think it's very important in that sense to get your thoughts, but Bill, you made a pretty radical comment, and I want you to share with the group and see how people react to it in terms of the preparers, the benefit, and all that. So could you elaborate? You touched on it in a way in your comment.
Only one radical comment?
One for a day is enough.
Which radical comment? Was that the one in the meeting?
There was only one standard, yeah.
Yeah, I made the comment, that, and this is about benefits to preparers. I said, I'm going to articulate it, I hope, better, because Bob quite rightly challenged me on it. I think the benefit, I could only think of one standard which has a direct benefit to the day-to-day running of the business, and that was cash flow statements. Now, that's quite a powerful powerful thing to consider, that when you're developing a standard, articulating benefits to preparers are difficult because the cash flow statement is beneficial to preparers. You know, I can look at it, I can see where my cash is going, I can do it on a roughly day-to-day basis, not quite monthly basis or weekly basis. There's a real direct benefit there. But very few other standards have that benefit. Bob touched on share-based payments and post-retirement benefits. I agree with share-based payments. If I'm a user of financial information as a preparer, so I can look at my subsidiary's submissions and I can say, wow, why has your share-based payment charge gone up so much? Did you just issue some awards you didn't tell us about? I disagree with post-retirement benefits from a UK point of view, because as management, my concern is more likely to be in the dialogue between management and the trust of the pension fund of how much cash. But the point it was touching on the fact that it is difficult to do a benefits analysis for preparers, but you have to do it very limited, direct business, day-to-day running benefits.
Anybody, just you, because we have some good time left, anybody to add or counter what Bill said? Any thoughts, any?
Yes, I also say that it seems to me very important that the financial reporting be the same internally and externally, because it's the best way to have, good figures, and that are representing the operational life. And I think that if standards are only accounted for external purpose and they, are, they cannot be used internally, there is a failure. Because for me, the fact that the reporting is the same internally and externally is a good message. Everyone has only one language, and the communication is fluent with analysts, and it's only the good way to have the same view on the business. So it has to be taken into account. Does the IFRS tomorrow will still be used internally or not?
I think when we had that discussion, it actually evolved a little bit, and the question, or one of the comments was, if a preparer is in the same line of business is using different internal information, one of the examples was the handheld with a service agreement, and one was two companies accounting for it internally differently. When we go and tell them that this is the right way to account for it, are you in then telling them that they weren't managing their business appropriately if they weren't doing that way? And I don't think that that's the case. I don't think that it's a yes or a no that they were doing it right or wrong. It's just that if the result is, from an accounting perspective, reflective of the economics and management, will still be able to effectively use the financial statements instead of making other adjustments to it, I think you've achieved the same thing.
Yeah, I think it touched on something that Kevin touched on and Alan touched on just as we got to the end of the session, maybe in different ways. But if the accounting standard results in a change in your business behavior, the way you run your business, you have to question whether the standard is doing the right thing. If you're engaged in a profitable business or a profitable area of business and you stop that, now that's an extreme example. It's unlikely to be a whole segment, but there may be elements of business behaviors that are profitable, optimal, whatever your way you want to describe it, and then you have to stop them because of an accounting standard. That does draw into question what the accounting standard has done. But you can't be, but having said that, you can't be expected to identify all those things in your effects analysis. Yeah. And it may be an exercise in looking on back on those unintended consequences that have happened.
I mean, it's been said a number of times about a broad approach and for example, impact on behavior. But how the heck shall we do this? How should we sit here and say that, I don't think you will invest in that type of business. I think you will leave that segment. And if you leave that segment, will someone else enter there and take that segment? Is that,
well, that
working together? Is that sort of a benefit or not? If you were there for accounting reason,
I think someone else comes there? I think that draws a little bit on what PK said, and we haven't answered, I don't believe, when he said some of these projects started 6 years ago. Only 6 years ago? Insurance
project.
15.
We want to be optimistic.
And then I think in your effects analysis, you have to, and I'll draw a model here, maybe honest and say, look, the effects analysis we've done are limited because when we started these projects, we operated in a different way and it wasn't optimal for an effects analysis. And they should evolve as you build up standards. Maybe you should build a framework what should be included in the effects analysis. I said about costs, maybe you should break it between users, preparers, regulators, others, which I know that Alan didn't like very much, or I don't think he did anyway. But draw that framework and then say, look, here are our effects analysis hit now. They're limited. This is the framework we want to operate on, and we can see these evolving in the next 4, 5, 6 years to respond more fully to that framework in the work we're doing at the moment. But it goes back to what I said, be honest and open about these things when you write them and say, look, this is the limitations. But directly back to your point, yeah, you're not expected to identify it, of course not. But take learnings and say that you consider them. For example, when the post-employment healthcare benefit guidance came in, 15 years ago, or what have you, certain companies stopped providing post-retirement health care to people. In the end, they were going to stop that in the end. They were going to get to that point. That probably advanced it. But those sort of examples are worth having in the back of your mind, those unintended consequences.
Those may be good consequences. Maybe it forced companies to recognize the fact that, as Bob said, that you're giving away the shop. It's really reflective of the economics of what's going on in the business decision making.
I agree.
Kevin?
It just crossed my mind that the effects analysis might be something that the ISB might want to publish only when it issues the final exposure draft, but might be something you want to evolve through the project. Because once you start identifying that the costs are going to exceed the benefits, it might be then slow the project down or even abandon the project. You know, probably Sandra and I are on the same page here. When the SEC issued conflict minerals and then said that it's going to cost $40 billion to implement, that sort of tells you that there's something wrong. Not let's go down and do it anyway, because yeah, you've probably got the same problem, Bob, as well in conflict minerals. So it's like, you know, something's telling you that there's something wrong here. Therefore, stop. Of course, they couldn't because of Congress, but stop before it gets there.
Yeah, actually, we had some type of discussion on the same thing about the ongoing effect of it. And the point I think that came up in that discussion was in the impairment, for example, to the one Gerard was talking about earlier, the first exposure draft pretty much met dust in that sense of the word was because of the cost aspect of it, right? So the point I'm trying to make is that by the time it comes to a standard level, I think all those issues have been dealt with. Maybe what you're suggesting is that maybe there should be a more robust discussion of that in the document, and that's a very fair comment. But some things which are like cost prohibitive, let's say, and those will not go further, so they don't even see the light of the day to become a standard. So having come to that level, there is that aspect of it.
And that might end up making the cost more palatable because all of this would have
and
been...
And also some compromise has been made. Some compromise has been made to, I think, the point that Sandra made in the beginning. It's like, you know, perfect answer to the operational answer. So that's the issue. Malcolm?
I've been focus quite a bit on this slide 11, where you actually have this draft due process handbook. And I guess it's a draft still. So I just wonder if you could think about tightening it up. And I like what Sandra said about right at the beginning, you set out with some high-level expectations of what you might be wanting to achieve as an effect. And then you've got a bit of a chicken and egg situation in this too, because you know it's only at the end. In fact, I don't even know how you can do an effects analysis all the way through the project, because you keep changing some of the requirements and what you're trying to achieve. So perhaps what I'm saying is, why don't you set out at the beginning what you think you could do? At the end, you'll do your best bet, perhaps, on what you think the effects might be. But then I'm sure after people start to use the standards, then it's only then, actually, you really understand the effects, because it might have, as Kevin was saying, wider-reaching effects than you actually could foresee when you wrote when you wrote it at the time of issuing the standards. I mean, I think you're only going to be able to
evaluate.
You're only going to be able to get, say, 70% there at the time of issuing the standards. It's only after you've implemented it that you really know the effects. So perhaps you could, I don't know, you could structure this due process handbook phrase a little bit differently. Some idea.
Sure. Hiroshi?
Yes. I read the effect analysis of IFRS 10, number 10, issued in September. Almost at the same time, EFRAG issued a paper of endorsement. That paper includes the effect analysis. For me, that EFRAG's paper is much more interesting and informative because they include include the operational difficulties, and they include the minority views. So for me, that ISV paper, I have an impression, most of the content to support the IFRS number 10. So probably you will need a different view. For one solution is to accept comments on the effect analysis.
Just tell you what you're missing, unfortunately, with the due process handbook is the other description that says that we are going to embed this through the whole process. And of course, it's much easier, as we discussed at the very end of our session, that with the newer projects, you do that up front. And then the way I see it is you have a fairly high level of what your expectations are. And you're going to see, I think, for the leases ED when it comes out, an effect analysis will be built into that. And that will give you an opportunity then to comment on that. Perhaps not as detailed as the work that EFRAG did, but we can't do detailed work yet because it's still only a proposal. So, but that's about 30 pages or thereabouts I've seen for the draft so far, which gives you sort of, I think, paints a picture of what we perceive to be the most of the changes to financial reporting and the cost-benefit considerations. And then, you know, the question is, have we got that right? So there's a chance, I think, at that stage to get feedback before we actually go and finalise. And I think that's what I've heard you say, Kevin, as well, about baking this in a little bit earlier. That's what we're planning to do with the new ones, and even with the existing ones, for the certainly for leases, that's built into that as well. And you're right too, Malcolm, we won't get it right, but that's what the post-implementation review will pick up, is how good we were at predicting what the likely effects would be. Now, if we've got it really badly wrong with financial reporting, you have to step in and intervene. If we've got it badly wrong with the costs, it's not a lot we can do because we've passed that point. But we can learn from that, and if we've actually got it badly wrong, then we will learn that there's a different approach we should be taking to assessing or measuring the costs. So, but I hope we don't get it badly wrong, because we'll have exposed what we think the likely costs are to be, or how easy it will be to transition into new requirements.
But Alan, something I said in our meeting, the caution you have with the cost one is that you don't want to get down into the approach where your cost estimate is horribly wrong and people start taking court orders against the ISB issuing standards. You've got to play that game as well.
It's not quantitative assessment. It's more of a qualitative assessment about the ease of transition, about whether or not retrospective accounting is appropriate because it's easy to do, or whether it is difficult to do because either the amount of judgment you have to apply in terms of hindsight bias, or whether it's just too difficult to get the information. So those are the more general, I think, assessments we've been making, as opposed to saying it's going to cost, on average, $12,450 per company, for example.
Okay. Alan, because I think we are right on time, so just to putting you on spot, if you don't mind, could you tell us from your outreach in other areas whether the views are consistent with what you have heard here to the other comments, or what has been the major difference, if you can say? Because this is predominantly the preparer, so that's why I want to make sure, what is the feedback you got from, let's say, the user group or something like that?
Consistently wide views, I think, is a. I think even within this group, I'm not hearing. I'm hearing slight differences about how broad this review ought to be in terms of the effects. And people talk about unintended consequences or things we hadn't anticipated, including whether or not people stop using instruments. I think about IFRS 3 and contingent consideration. Maybe people stop or change the way they actually enter into contingent consideration contracts or arrangements. And that's, I don't know if they call that an unintended consequence. We think that's probably a likely thing. People react to the way requirements are actually in place. Whether we're supposed to anticipate that is another issue. But I think I'm hearing quite broad range of what we should be thinking about. Much more consistency about be very careful with qualitative assessments, particularly with costs. And a consistent message is that we should be doing this throughout the process as well. So I think that's consistent. If I had one way to summarise this, actually it came out of our group, was that I actually think it's almost like the way board members think. If the board members went into a public forum and actually had to explain and communicate why it was they made those decisions, from what I hear from here, the preparers here, you'd like to be able to sit there and perhaps use our analysis to sit down and explain to the CFOs or the CEO why it is that we've forced a change in accounting. And once you've got the financial statements prepared, go along to the analyst meeting and be able to explain why it is that the information you're producing has changed. So in other words, we've given you the tools to actually explain inward and outwardly what it is and why it's a good accounting assessment, for example. And I think if we're able to do that, then you would probably be reasonably happy. I don't know if that overstates it. But it means that you've explained internally, and to Olivia's point, you've got a consistency between internal and external, and you can explain to the analysts why the financials have changed.